Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Leeds, West Yorkshire, United Kingdom, and graduated with a first in BSc Government from the London School of Economics. He's the founder of the Taxpayers Alliance for Britain, which formed the basis for the Vote Leave campaign. He's known as the brains behind Brexit and an unsung titan of the Brexit cause, and is credited with turning public opinion against the Brexit vote from 2-1 in favor to 2-1 against it. His name? Matthew Elliott. And I'm Jack Prisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Prisula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Matthew Elliott, who's known as the brains behind Brexit and an unsung titan of the Brexit cause. Matthew, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you.
Can we start by you talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, I was born and brought up in Leeds, which is a city in the north of England, in Yorkshire. And brought up in Leeds. My father was a social worker, and my mum was a teacher, and now she's a priest. They're both in the now of retirement age. And I had a really great childhood back in Leeds, and this was in the... I was born in 1978, so I was brought up in the 1980s in Leeds. And at the time, the country was going through quite a change. Of course, we had Margaret Thatcher as our Prime Minister, just like you had Ronald Reagan as your President. And a bit like in America, there was lots going on in the economy. My dad was actually a trade unionist. So he was sort of part of many strikes and agitating for higher pay. And I remember lots of arguments at the Sunday lunch table between my father and my grandfather, who was much more on Margaret Thatcher's side, much more on the free market side of things. And I think that's where I really get my politics from my grandfather, who was owned a small shop after the war and then became head of food retail for a department store across the country, nationwide department store. So he was in a sense, the entrepreneur and the political entrepreneur who inspired me.
All right, Matthew, it's one thing to have a dream to become a politician or a political strategist. It's another thing to become one. How did you ever become a political strategist?
Well, I was always interested in politics, and one of my oldest friends, Matt Stevens, who I'm still very friendly with, I remember he would come over for sleepovers, and even when you're in our early teens, we'd be arguing about politics together. And after finishing school at the age of 18, I then took a year out, a gap year, and I worked for my local Member of Parliament, and this was the run-up to the 1997 general election, which the Conservative Party lost very heavily in the UK when Tony Blair became Prime Minister. And I was on his campaign, and it was my first taste of defeat. I was sure he was going to win his seat, but very sadly he lost. But I went to university to study politics and kept an active interest. But what really interested me was not so much the party politics or the electoral politics, but actually the ideas. I was really inspired at school by learning about economists like Milton Friedman and his Free to Choose TV series. And that really inspired me into the classical liberal, the free market way of seeing the economy. So soon after leaving the LSE, I founded a group called the Taxpayers Alliance, which was is a lobby group for lower taxes and better government spending, a bit like groups like Americans for Tax Reform or the National Taxpayers Union. So I got my my kick from really pushing the free market message and really bringing sort of liberty and low taxes to the UK.
You did that in 2004 at age 26. Let's go back to 1993, speaking about you enjoyed ideas, and this European Union is formed.
Yep.
Matthew, what was the concept back then?
Well, when the EU was formed after the war, it really started off as being a trade bloc. So a bit like NAFTA, if you like. But then Britain joined in the early 1970s, and people thought they were voting to join what would be a trade bloc. And when tariffs were very high, it was a logical thing for Britain to join that trade bloc, particularly when our economy was doing so badly in the 1970s. But it very quickly turned into being a political union, the extent to which we now have 60% of our laws made at the EU level. But the key turning point, you're right, was really in the early 1990s with a treaty called the Maastricht Treaty. And when that came in, that was the key point, really, when the EU went from being an economic union, which made some sense for Britain to be part of, to being a political union on the road to being a United States of Europe, something which people in the UK rightly don't want.
You wrote the change or go policy. What was that policy, please?
Well, when it came to about 2013, David Cameron rightly came to the conclusion that we needed to renegotiate our membership of the EU and then put that new membership, that reformed membership, to the British public in a referendum. And when he came out with his policy, which I thought was a very sensible policy from the then Prime Minister, I started writing a book called Change or Go. And it basically made the argument that unless the European Union changes, we should leave. But I outlined the different ways in which it needed to change to get back to being a free trade area rather than being a political union. And I also wrote in that book basically how Britain could leave and how we could have a free trade relationship with the EU and also play a part in a global world again, have trade policies right across the world. So in a sense, that was one of the key books behind the European policy. Now, the sad conclusion was that David Cameron wasn't able to get any changes from our membership. That meant that, reluctantly, I was on the leave side, on the go side, if you like, when it came to the referendum.
We're talking to Matthew Elliott. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the campaign to win Brexit. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Matthew Elliott, who's joining us from the UK, the author of four books, and also he's known as the brains behind Brexit. All right, Matthew, talk to us about the campaign. When you started this Brexit, 2-1, the people in the United Kingdom wanted to stay in the European Union. And then when they voted on June 23rd, 2016, 2-1, they voted against it. How did you get 60 million plus people to change their mind?
Well, it was quite a campaign. It was an epic battle. We did lots of preparation over many years. It should be this battle should be seen as a decades-old battle, really going back to the early 1990s. And I played a role in basically the final 10 years of it. First of all, through the Taxpayers Alliance, and then through a group I set up called Business for Britain, which then morphed into the Vote Leave referendum campaign, which was the official referendum campaign for Leave. So it was a long battle, but really the final sprint came after the 2015 general election in the UK, where David Cameron, the then Prime Minister, unexpectedly got a majority of seats in the House of Commons, which put him in the position of having to have this referendum. And as soon as that happened, and as soon as it became clear that he wasn't going to succeed in getting a better deal for the EU, for the UK from the EU, I then put my mind to setting up this Don't Leave campaign. And one of the key points was that I knew it needed to be a campaign that appealed to the swing voter, to the mainstream, moderate, sensible voter. So I set up an organisation that would bring in conservatives, people like former London Mayor Boris Johnson, who's now our Foreign Secretary, and also people from the Labour Party as well, such as Gisela Stewart, who had been one of Tony Blair's envoys to the EU. But it also brought in some quite senior business people, so people behind Sir James Dyson, for example, behind all the Dyson goods. He was a supporter of the campaign. So really, the campaign was set up to be pitched to those swing voters. And that was the key point. We weren't trying to argue the case for Leave from the extremes of politics. We were putting forward a very moderate and sensible and rational explanation of why Britain would be better off outside the EU.
You had almost no money, and you brilliantly used social media and data to make this transformation. Talk about, in elections going forward, the power of data.
Well, social media and data is king now when it comes to elections. You know, not just with the Vote Leave campaign, just look at the recent campaign of President Macron in France, where he literally set up a new political party 18 months ago and then went on to win the presidency, and his party went on to triumph in the National Assembly elections as well. And that was in 18 months, thanks to social media. And we did pretty much the same thing. We used Facebook in particular to be able to reach out to voters right across the UK. With the core voters, the people who are all ready for Leave, making sure they went out to vote. And with those swing voters, those people whose hearts were telling them to actually leave the EU, to vote to leave the EU, but whose heads had some concerns about Britain leaving, we sought to persuade them. We persuade them using a few simple arguments. First of all, talking about the amount of money which the UK sends the EU every year. Every week it's some £350 million which we send to the EU. Then we talked about the risks of Remain, how if Britain's stayed in the EU, how things will get worse, how power will be further centralised, how the EU become ever more powerful, and how migration would still be a concerning issue. And then we pointed out that the business community were divided. And in fact, it was the entrepreneurs who were behind the big job creation schemes, who were the ones who were on the Leave side. So if they wanted to make sure their jobs were safe, they should stick with the entrepreneurs. So really, we use social media to stack up our core vote, but also make sure that we, first of all, converted the swing vote to our side, and then made sure they went along to actually vote on polling day on the 23rd of June.
72% of the eligible people went out and voted, and it was a huge surprise. Matthew Elliott, why did the UK ultimately vote to leave the European Union?
We had one simple slogan: take back control, take back control. And I think what motivated people was the fact that we'd given up power in so many different areas. You know, some 60% of laws in the UK being made by the EU. And people felt that the UK, as the fifth largest economy in the world, as number one for soft power in some indices, as a significant military presence, why on earth couldn't we look after our own laws? So really it was a sovereignty point. It was an independence point. People were voting to take back control over lawmaking, so politicians in the UK will be responsible, and they could be held accountable at elections, rather than being unable to hold to account the unelected politicians in Brussels.
You mentioned 60% of the British law emanated from the EU court, which was in Brussels, of course. You changed the direction of a country, of a whole continent. What do you think about that?
Well, I played a key role in bringing it all together. You are absolutely right. But I always say to people that it was, and it was a real team effort. I was just so privileged to be in the position of being able to bring together that, star team, from the very charismatic Boris Johnson, the former Mayor of London, from some of the best entrepreneurs in the UK who supported Business for Britain, from some of the sensible people in other parties like Gisela Stewart, but also the volunteers, the activists, many of whom got involved in politics for the very first time because this issue is so important to them. So I feel hugely privileged to be able to be the person to build this coalition and, yes, set the strategy as well, but really being the person to build that coalition to get our successful result.
8 months ago, Matthew Elliott, there was another shocking election. Donald Trump became president on November 8th, 2016. 63 million people voted. How did that happen?
I think in some ways there are some similarities with the UK. There's some differences too, but I'll talk through some of the similarities. I think that both electorates in the UK and the US felt that the political elite, perhaps, had lost touch with ordinary members of the public. And they were out of touch in their Washington, D.C. bubble, or the London bubble, or the Brussels bubble. And they weren't really in touch with the ordinary concerns of people. And people have had a hard time since the financial crisis. In the U.K., for example, real wages, when you take into account inflation, have actually gone down in the past 10 years. So people are feeling really quite poor and quite unlooked after. So when you had the Vote Leave campaign or Donald Trump coming along and saying they wanted to shake up the system, to do things differently, to actually listen to the concerns of voters in the Rust Belt or in the UK sense, voters outside of London, that was rightly very attractive. These were people who wanted to do things differently and for once were listening to ordinary members of the public and their concerns.
Why were the experts in Britain and in America so wrong in their predictions in both elections?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the more independently minded pollsters, the people who really dug down into the data, both in the UK and the US, they both recognised that actually there was a chance that Leave could win and that Donald Trump could win. But I think that more generally, the pollsters, they went along with a herd mentality. And often they are stuck in the same bubble in Washington, D.C. or in London and are often out of touch with ordinary citizens. And what struck me, actually both in the UK and in the US, I spent a month in the US running up to the US presidential election, was that when you got out of the big cities and actually spoke to people and listened to their concerns, you could see that something was actually happening. Something was rising up. People wanted to have that change. So actually, for me, when Donald Trump became president, I wasn't actually that surprised. I didn't predict it. I wasn't one of these people who did. But it didn't surprise me that it happened.
We're talking to Matthew Elliott, who's one of the most formidable political strategists in Britain, and I'd argue, in the world today. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Matthew Elliott, who's credited with turning public opinion against the Brexit vote from 2-1 in favor to staying in the Union to 2-1 against it. Matthew, in America, the animosity, the polarization, the hatred today between the two factions is amazing. What do you see going forward?
Well, We've seen some of that animosity in the UK as well, when it comes to Leave and Remain. You know, at first, feelings were very, very raw right after the referendum last year. Thankfully, though, with Theresa May becoming Prime Minister so quickly after the referendum, because she'd been on the Remain side in the debate, things started to calm down. And when people saw that the economy hadn't been driven off a cliff and that actually Britain had the highest growth rate in the G7 in the final two quarters of last year, people started to come round to the idea, to the extent that if you do polling now, some 70% of people are now actually happy with the fact that we left and actually want the PM to, you know, continue with Brexit and are happy with her plans. And I think that similarly in the United States, I recognise that things are still very divisive following the presidential election. But I think that if the president's policies on the economy start to work, so that medicine starts to work, and you start to see a return of the 3 or even 3.5% growth rates that America has traditionally had, and then you start to see the creation of new jobs for people and a rise in the real incomes for people, then I think people will think it's been worthwhile. The trick is, the key question is, can the president do that? And certainly from my perspective, my looking at it from the UK, that's the thing I'll be following.
Speaking of can the president do that, he famously coined this phrase, drain the swamp. Well, we've come to realize in the last 6-7 months that the swamp is extremely big, extremely entrenched, and hell-bent on defeating him. Matthew Elliott, in the end, won't the swamp win?
I'm hopeful that it won't, because I can actually see in President Trump somebody who has tremendous drive, who's fearless, who has a lot of courage, and who is willing to take on the system. You know, he has been in some, he's built up his own business. And also, in his business career, he's been in some pretty sticky places, but he's always managed to fight back. And I think that what the system has needed in the States is that fighter. And if anybody can do it, I think Donald Trump is the person. And I think another point to make is that he's doing things differently to traditional politicians. So a traditional politician would get into office and would take their time in terms of rolling out their policy plans and building their coalitions, and everything would take, you know, a very long time. Whereas I think with Donald Trump, he's gone in there and has shaken things up. It's a bit like a businessman taking over what he sees to be a company which perhaps is failing or certainly not living up to its potential. And he's really shaking up the system. He's made some big calls, some big changes on things like Obamacare and making sure that America wasn't signed up to the Paris Agreement, and he's talking about bringing in the very big tax cuts to kickstart the economy and to attract back some of that money from the US corporates, which is held overseas. If these three big calls come good, and if he's able to drive them all through, I think there's a real chance that he will get that significant economic growth of 3.5% that will deliver the jobs and make it all worthwhile.
A streetwise friend of mine from Boston recently told me, Jack, when you have more people on the bus than you have people pushing the bus, you got a problem. And in this country, we got half the people on the dole and other half of people pushing that bus. Matthew Elliott, who's going to win?
Well, the key to solving that is job creation. And, you know, job creation requires the government to get the economy going again, which means making sure that, you know, taxes on businesses are lower than what they are. At the moment, corporate tax in the US is much higher than it is in Europe, for example. It also means making sure that regulation isn't too burdensome, particularly for the smaller companies. Now, the smaller companies are the ones who are the real creators of jobs in any economy. So what Ronald Reagan did when he was president. He exempted all companies from, I think, under 10 employees from memory, from all sorts of regulations. This really was a big boost to the US economy. So if you do those two things and make sure that the economy is not stifled with red tape from things like the Paris Agreement, and also make sure that, you know, trade is fair and that the US has the right trade deals with countries like the UK, which I hope it has a trade deal with very soon. All these will actually help, I think, make sure the economy gets going, start that job creation, and make sure that there are more people, you know, pushing the bus, if you like, making sure the bus goes faster.
On May 22nd of this past year, at 10:30 p.m., you had the Manchester terror attack in your country. 22 people died, 50-plus injured. In a way, it was like your 9/11. Now, 2.5 months later, how has that changed the country and your people?
Well, this was a huge part of the referendum of the election campaign as well, of course, in recent months. And to have those all those different terror attacks, you know, coincide with an election campaign was quite something. I think it really focused people's minds. You know, first of all, to make sure that we have, you know, the right number of police officers. I think more investment will be going into that. And also to make sure that the government has the right powers to track down these terrorists before they actually commit these atrocities. So in a sense, the debate has been a little superficial because it's been an election campaign and they're never good places to debate the detail of policy. But, you know, with Parliament now resumed after the election, I know that this will be a key area that MPs will be looking at, just to make sure that the police, the Home Office, the intelligence services all have the right powers they need to crack down on these vile terrorists.
You mentioned the referendum that was held on June 9th of this year. And you, we emailed a week before and you said, Jack, and I quote you, the Prime Minister will win, but not with a stonking majority. Well, she lost the majority, so it was a huge shocker. Why did that happen, Matthew?
I think books will be written about this for years to come, about gambles that have gone wrong. I think there are a couple of mistakes. The first one was underestimating the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn. Most people in the media saw him as being practically a joke figure who anybody could easily beat, and they thought that because he was from the hard left of politics, from the socialist left of politics, they thought it'd be a walk in the park for the Conservative Party to beat him. But actually, he's a guy who's been a campaigner all his life, and actually he did very well during the election in terms of appealing to people and connecting with people, and his approval ratings went right up, and that's one of the key reasons why he managed to win over so many seats from the Conservatives. I think the other problem was the Conservative Party manifesto or platform, if you like. Now, the Brexit part was very popular, and that went down a storm in the country. But in the rest of the manifesto, there wasn't that retail offer for people. So whereas Jeremy Corbyn is offering concrete reasons why people should vote Labour, on the Conservative side, there weren't those positive reasons. There wasn't really that positive case other than Brexit. So I think the key lesson to learn is don't underestimate your opponents and also make sure that you have a positive retail offer for voters.
We're talking to Matthew Elliott and realize this man is 39 years old. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible. We're talking to Matthew Elliott, and in 2017, he became a senior fellow at the Legatum Institute. Matthew, Jeremy Corbyn, one of the things that he offered to the young people was free tuition. And the young people voted for him in droves. So he's a Santa Claus in a way.
And well, you can imagine how popular that policy was with younger voters. And, you know, usually voters under the age of 25 come out in about sort of 50% turnout in an election. And this actually drove their turnout up to close to 70% because they're really attracted by that offer. The lesson I've learned from that is that we need to teach younger people and some older voters too that politicians can't act like Santa Claus, that there isn't a magic money tree that the government can go to pay for all of these free things. And that's something which I think think tanks and commentators like myself, but also politicians, have to start explaining to voters that actually, you know, the government needs to live within its means, that actually people do need to, you know, pay for their tuition. You know, these are very basic points. You can't nationalise the trains. That was one of his other policies. So really, we need to educate people about the value and the necessity for a good economy of the free enterprise economy. So that's one of the things I will be looking at, you know, following the election, to make sure we get that message out loud and clear.
How does this latest shocking election affect the Brexit negotiations going forward?
Well, thankfully, both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, who between them got 85% of the vote, if you combine both of them, both of them were committed to a good, clean Brexit, of you know, fully withdrawing Britain from the EU so we can do the right trade deals around the world. So they were, you know, fully behind the right policy. So I feel that Brexit still has a strong mandate. Now, I know that some politicians will try and push back against it and try and water it down and try to rerun the referendum. But I don't think the electorate will have any truck with that. They voted for Brexit and they want Britain to leave the EU. And the Prime Minister has a very clear mandate for that.
You won't actually really leave the EU until early 2019. And there's a prevailing belief within the EU that Britain is doomed by leaving the EU. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't propose leave if I thought this was the case. I actually think that Britain will do better economically outside of the EU. We've been held back by too many regulations for the EU. But also, frankly, we haven't had the trade deals we need. You know, the EU is a customs union as well, so we all have the same tariffs from around the world. And the EU has become too protectionist. So, for example, you know, there isn't a trade deal between the EU and the United States. Now, the United States is a huge export destination for UK companies, just like the UK is a huge export destination for US companies as well. So I feel that if we need to reconnect with the 80% of the world economy that's outside of the EU, we need to make sure that we leave so we can build up those trade relationships for the future. You know, sadly, the EU isn't doing so well economically. So we need to make sure we've got the right trade deals with strong economies like the US and also fast-growing economies like India and China. That's where our future growth and prosperity will come from.
The German people will go to the election polls in September. What's your prediction for that election?
I think that Angela Merkel will be re-elected as Chancellor in Germany. I think that she's very popular over there. She's a real sort of stateswoman. And frankly, that's good for Brexit because she is a pragmatist too. She realises the win-win situation on the table, that if with the right deal, it can benefit both Britain and the rest of the EU. So she's pragmatic, and I really hope that she wins.
This Brexit movement, Donald Trump movement, this uprising, etc., do you see this spreading to other countries throughout the world?
I think there's definitely an anti-establishment feeling out there. So you see it in other countries too. So France, which has recently elected President Macron, he had to set up his own party, a new party, to be able to be elected in the space of 18 months. Look at the Five Star Movement in Italy. They've got elections coming up later in the year. That's very much an anti-establishment, anti-status quo party. They're doing very well. So yes, this isn't just confined to the US and the UK. This is something going on right across the Western world.
One thing that Americans marvel about is your royal family and your devotion to the royal family. Talk about that devotion.
We love the royal family in the UK. The Queen is a superb head of state. Of course, she doesn't have any political power, you know, like the President of the United States does. She is symbolic, a ceremonial head for the UK generally. But I think she's really proved herself. She's a really wise woman, the Queen. I just think how many prime ministers have served under her, everybody from Winston Churchill onwards. Just think how many world leaders, how many US presidents she's met during her time as Queen. So from all of that experience, it means that she's able to give very good advice to prime ministers. And they see her once a week in a weekly audience, and she has no power to tell them what to do. But I think her wisdom and her advice is much sought after by all of the prime ministers.
As our time winds down this evening, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
I think the key piece of advice I would give is don't limit your dreams. Now, when I was in my early 20s, I'd left university. I was working in Parliament, and I could see this niche, this need for a taxpayer group in the UK. And I didn't know any journalists or any donors or many people in politics, but I had that dream of setting up this group. And I worked hard at it, and I sought advice from people, including people in the States who had already set up these groups. And I put together a little business plan for it and raised some money. And as soon as I had that 3 months' worth of money in the bank, I quit my job and went for it full throttle. And I haven't looked back since. So my key piece of advice is don't limit your dreams. You know, chase your dreams. If you can see an issue that you want to you know, set a group up on or win, like I won the EU referendum, you know, go for it and go for it today.
Matthew Elliott, what a courageous person and what a shining example of with God, anything is possible. Thank you. Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening and make it a great week because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.
Believe in yourself.